Thursday at noon, we settled down at the table on the porch and thanked the Lord for the delicious meal we were about to receive. Esau was at work. As the garden ripened in late summer, we had enjoyed many vegetarian lunches. Red and yellow tomatoes, cucumbers and onions in vinegar, butter beans, snap beans, peas, okra, squash, boiled potatoes, corn on the cob, and always hot cornbread. Now, as the air was cooler and the leaves were turning, Miss Callie was preparing heartier dishes: duck stew, lamb stew, chili, red beans and rice with pork sausage, and the old standby, pot roast. The meal that day was chicken and dumplings. I was eating slowly, something she had encouraged me to do. I was half through when I said, "Sam called me, Miss Callie." She paused and swallowed, then said, "How is he?"
"He's fine.
He wants to come home this Christmas, said everybody else was coming back, and he wants to be here."
"Do you know where he is?" she asked.
"Do you?"
"No.
He's in Memphis. We're supposed to meet tomorrow up there."
"Why are you meeting with Sam?"
She seemed very suspicious of my involvement.
"He wants me to help him.
Max and Bobby told him about our friendship. He said he thinks I'm a white person who can be trusted."
"It could be dangerous," she said.
"For who?"
"Both of you."
Her doctor was concerned about her weight. At times she was too, but not always. With particularly heavy dishes like stews and dumplings, she took small portions and ate slowly. The news of Sam gave her a reason to stop eating altogether. She folded her napkin and began talking. Sam left Clanton in the middle of the night on a Greyhound bus headed for Memphis. He called Callie and Esau when he arrived there. The next day, a friend drove up with some money and clothing. As the story about Iris broke fast around town, Callie and Esau were convinced their youngest son was about to be murdered by the cops. Highway patrol cars eased by their house at all hours of the day and night. There were anonymous phone calls with threats and abusive language. Mr. Cohn filed some papers in court. A hearing date came and went without Sam's appearance. Miss Callie never saw an official indictment, but then she wasn't sure what one looked like. Memphis seemed too close, so Sam drifted to Milwaukee, where he hid with Bobby for a few months. For 2 years now, he had drifted from one sibling to the next, always traveling at night, always afraid that he was about to be caught. The older Ruffin children called home often and wrote once a week, but they were afraid to mention Sam. Someone might be listening.
"He was wrong to get involved with a woman like that," Miss Callie said, sipping tea.
I had effectively ruined her lunch, but not mine.
"But he was so young. He didn't chase her."
The next day, I became the unofficial go-between for Sam Ruffin and his parents. We met in a coffee shop in a shopping mall in South Memphis. From somewhere in the distance, he watched me wait for 30 minutes before he popped in from nowhere and sat across from me. 2 years on the run had taught him a few tricks. His youthful face was showing the strain of life on the lam. Out of habit, he continually looked right and left. He tried mightily to hold eye contact, but he could do it only for a few seconds. Not surprisingly, he was soft-spoken, articulate, very polite, and quite thankful that I had been willing to step forward and explore the possibility of helping him. He thanked me for the courtesies and friendship I'd shown his mother. Bobby in Milwaukee had shown him the Times stories. We talked about his siblings, his movements from UCLA to Duke, then to Toledo, then to Grinnell in Iowa. He couldn't live like that much longer. He was desperate for a resolution to the mess at home so he could get on with a normal life. He finished high school in Milwaukee and planned eventually to go to law school, but he couldn't do it living like a fugitive.
"There's a fair amount of pressure on me, you know," he said. "7 brothers and sisters, 7 PhDs.
I described my fruitless search for an indictment, my inquiries to Sheriff Coley, and my conversation with Harry Rex about Mr. Durant's current mood. Sam thanked me profusely for this information and for my willingness to get involved. "There's no threat of being arrested," I assured him.
There is, however, the threat of catching a bullet. I'd rather be arrested, he said.
Me too.
He's a very scary man, Sam said of Mr. Durant. A story followed, one in which I did not get all the details. Seems as though Iris was now living in Memphis. Sam kept in touch. She had told him some horrible things about her ex-husband and her two teenaged boys and the threats they had made against her. She was not welcome anywhere in Ford County. Her life might be in danger, too. The boys repeatedly said they hated her and never wanted to see her again. She was a broken woman who was racked with guilt and suffering a nervous breakdown. And it's my fault, Sam said. I was raised better. Our meeting lasted an hour, and we promised to get together in a couple of weeks. He handed me two thick letters he had written to his parents, and we said goodbye. He disappeared in a crowd of shoppers, and I couldn't help but ask myself where an 18-year-old kid hides. How does he travel, move around? How does he survive day to day? And Sam was not some street kid who had learned to live by his wits and fists. I told Harry Rex about our meeting in Memphis. My lofty goal was to somehow convince Mr. Durant to leave Sam alone. Since I was living under the assumption that my name was on a not-so-favored list somewhere on Paget Island, I had no desire to have it added to another list. I swore Harry Rex to secrecy and had no trouble believing he would protect my role as the intermediary. Sam would agree to leave Ford County to finish high school up north, then stay there for college and probably for the rest of his life. The kid simply wanted to be able to see his parents, to have short visits in Clanton, and to be able to live without looking over his shoulder. Harry Rex didn't care, nor did he want to get involved. He promised to relay the message to Mr. Durant, but he wasn't optimistic it would get a sympathetic ear.
"He's a nasty sumbitch," he said more than once.